Hello, and welcome to the Governance Matters podcast from Governance Intelligence, formerly known as Corporate Secretary. In this show, we examine the work of governance professionals and the latest developments they face. I'm your host, Editor-at-Large Ben Maiden. Later on in the show, we hear from Michael Handman, partner with Holland & Knight, about the likely impact of two new DOJ initiatives designed to encourage executives to tell the government about potential wrongdoing at their companies. But our first guest today is Bruce Goldfarb, President and CEO of proxy solicitation and investor response firm Okapi Partners. He and his firm have been closely involved in the two stand-up proxy contests of the year so far, at Disney and at Starbucks. And Goldfarb spoke to me about the lessons these fights have for boards and governance professionals. Okapi Partners represented Nelson Peltz's Trian Partners in the Disney case, and they worked with the SOC, a coalition of labor unions that nominated three director candidates to the Starbucks board before withdrawing those candidates after an agreement was reached with the company to work toward a framework on collective bargaining. Both Disney and Starbucks have large retail investor bases, and I began by asking Goldfarb about how this impacts proxy contests. So hi, Bruce, thanks for being here today. So you were involved with the proxy contests at Disney and Starbucks, and both of those are companies with large retail investor bases. In addition, they're obviously taking place under the relatively new universal proxy option, I should say. So what lessons can boards at other companies learn in terms of retail shareholder outreach from these cases? And slightly separately from that, are there any takeaways for governance teams about working with a universal proxy card?
Ben, always great to talk with you. And it has been
you too.
An interesting proxy season this year, having, as you point out, worked on campaigns at Starbucks and Disney, both of which have large retail shareholder populations. And what's a little unique about each company is that the shareholders are very much consumers of the products that the companies sell. And so in many ways here, you have customers who are shareholders, very informed about the product, have very strong opinions about the companies, and yet not necessarily did they fully understand or appreciate the proxy fight, the issues that occur, the process to vote, or even a desire in some instances to take action. So if you think about a company like Starbucks, the same customer who could be a shareholder will go to the store possibly every day, but won't necessarily vote the shares of the company. And prior to a proxy fight, these companies don't even really spend an awful lot of time engaging with these individual investors. And you see that in the voting results from either company prior to the proxy fight. You can see the relatively low quorum for each company. You can see the relatively elevated size of the broker vote for these shares. In a proxy fight, you need to vote your own shares to have vote count. So if you are working on the company side, you recognize that the solicitation campaign is very different than what you see. And certainly when we work for the company, we help them appreciate that. But when we work for the activists, we know not only do we need to get investors to overcome their apathy and take action, but you have to incur expense that can be significantly greater than any expense that either the company or an investor usually takes. And so especially with well-known brands where the investor is familiar with product, but not necessarily performance, you need to really get that message out. And that means with each of these campaigns, it's not only about highlighting what the issues were about a need for change, and that need for change being different for either campaign. And then also explaining how you're going to effectuate that change. What I think is interesting in both campaigns is that the need for change wasn't necessarily so disputed by the companies, in that each company took action that met some of or many of the points that were espoused by the activists. And so what we take away from either of these campaigns is that much of the campaign is brought forth through media, through social media, through outreach that's echoed and repeated through the media, but also through traditional solicitation means, sending out proxy cards, sending out reminder mailings with additional proxy cards, making phone calls to individual investors, in addition to communicating with a large array of institutional shareholders during these campaigns, and creating messaging that is designed for the proxy voting advisory firms, as well as the institutions and the retail side. Clearly, these campaigns demonstrate that the retail can be a significant to outcome. I don't know that you can say that it was outcome determinative here, but there was the possibility. And you'd asked earlier about the universal proxy card. There's an area where the retail shareholder has a very different methodology of voting than they've become accustomed to in any proxy campaign in the past. They have the ability to vote for up to the number of directors being elected, but that they have more choices on their ballot. So not only do you need to educate about how many nominees you can select, you need to educate about the methodology for doing it. And the proxy card that you receive puts the nominees in different order. And so as an activist advisor, we may not care which proxy card the investors vote on, which is a contrast to the campaigns that were run prior to the universal proxy card. But we do want the investors to be able to take action in the best way possible. And that requires education, and that requires a lot of handholding on the retail side. And it's not just helping the investor to overcome their apathy, it's then to get them to act in the right way. And so the challenge was even greater with the Disney campaign, where you had a third party involved and you were receiving not one, not two, but three potentially different proxy cards set up in different order and without a very explicit campaign about how to vote and why you're taking that action. You could have unpredictable results.
Obviously, before the universal proxy card came in, there was a lot of discussion, obviously, about what is it like the impact would be. And these people I spoke to range from saying it'll have no impact really at all to people who like the sky was falling. Based on your experiences working through a couple of campaigns at least, I don't know if you've been involved in any others. Do you think it will have a major impact on the dynamics of campaigns that going forward, or is it once people are used to, like you say, the educative part of is covered, then it's just sort of relatively business as usual?
Well, I don't, it's new business as will be usual, if that makes any. But what is different is that every campaign requires that education about who you're voting for and why you're selecting that nominee, and with retail shareholders, the practicality of where to find them. What I think is different and will continue to be different, but business as usual, is the fact that you are targeting particular nominees on the board. You're targeting incumbents, and you're also, as an activist, demonstrating why you're going to bring something of value to that board. And so you've created more of a political type of election campaign, investor candidate against against incumbent candidate. And you're truly in adding in this political, like, I want to be elected, and here's who I am, and here's my platform, and here's my background. Whereas in prior campaigns, that sense of replacement of a particular board member, that sense of the individual as a candidate, was not quite as strong. In all of the other aspects, though, I have seen working on these campaigns for both investors and companies that there's an awful lot of business as usual. The institutional investors understand the process. The proxy voting advisory firms have been relatively clear about how they view this process. And there have been very few surprises in terms of how elections turn out. If you were to examine the shareholder base of a company and look at the result, I haven't seen a lot of campaigns that are shockingly surprising.
Right.
And I don't know that we're going to say, oh, it's the card that impacted the campaign rather than the campaign income impacting the outcome.
Sure. And just going back a little bit to you to the retail investor outreach that you were talking about. Obviously, in when there's engagement with institutions, board members may or may not be involved, whether it's particularly when just in terms of regular annual sort of engagement. But what do you see the role of the board being when there is more of a retail component to that outreach? How does it affect their work?
It's clear that there is more of a need to focus on who the candidates are. And with respect to the Disney campaign and the Starbucks campaign, on the side, on the investor side, you saw that the candidates, the nominees, were absolutely willing to engage with shareholders, whether it was in town hall kind of forum, whether it was creating video information about the candidates, willingness to make use of social media and put forth the bios. There's so many ways where you can reach people, reach individual investors, even in a world where you're not necessarily going out and shaking hands because the dynamics of the world have changed that way. There's still a retail politics point of view to getting investor votes. That is part of the process. But that's also true on the institutional side and on any campaign where we work that's successful. And I don't think it matters whether it's the investor or the company. The candidates, the nominees need to be participants in communicating with the investors. And in so many of the dialogue that occurred between institutional investors and our client, the nominees were there. They were front and center having discussions. There were times where one of the candidates was available when the institution had time to speak, and we made time for the other candidate to meet the institution because that's who you're supporting to be on the board. Those are going to be your representatives. And with that in mind, those are going to be the people that are going to help create value for the shares that you own in the company. That's going to be the fact of proxy fights in the next few years. And if I could make one additional point about these two proxy fights in particular, it's clear that shareholder activism is going to remain a significant part of the governance world, of the corporate world, of the proxy world. We've seen demonstrated value created. And interestingly, in both of these situations, the nominees are the elected directors or those who were nominated by management. But look at the impact that the campaigns had on stated direction for the company. Look at where prices move during the campaign, but look at the promises that are made that are designed to create value. If there's a takeaway, it's that investors win when there are active investors talking about a company.
So board members, do you have to embrace that side of things? Might that become then part of a consideration when recruiting board members? Like, is this someone who potentially we could put out there who would be willing to and able to be an effective advocate? Obviously, not every company is going to face this type of situation, but it maybe it's something that would a factor to be borne in mind.
Certainly is a consideration, but it also depends on what the company needs to create value around the boardroom. And so whether You know, whether you're saying we need somebody who really understands sales and business development, or whether we're saying we need somebody who really understands intellectual property or some science-based matter, you may end up with somebody who has a different sense of how to be good at retail politics, but you still may be bringing forth the best candidate. And investors can appreciate that. It's a nuance. It's you look at how you campaign differently, but ultimately it's about the better or best candidates that you bring forth who are going to create value.
And as you said, in both cases we're talking about today, did result in company taking action. In the Starbucks case, for example, they've been sort of getting together with the unions. I think they re have a overcome some impasse this week to, work on some discussions around collective bargaining, for example. So that being said, what do you sort of see as the role of the board in similar situations or other companies in terms of making sure that companies follow through on any either any actions it promises to make during the course of a contest, and how can sort of governance professionals best help boards do that, best help keep them in either informed or help them make sure that these action promises are implemented?
Part of a board's role is to make sure that a promise made is a promise kept, or there's some explanation as to why something can't happen the way it was originally promised in a manner that's not going to create additional risk to value for the company, or is not going to, be problematic. Because a board who doesn't hold management accountable to following through on promises is a board that's vulnerable to attack. A management team who makes promises that are not founded in deep thought with considering the risk to value and the expense that can be incurred relative to the reward is going to be subject to further review, and the board will be subject to a lot of scrutiny. So board members should know that they will be examined relative to performance and operational excellence it relative to promises made.
And just lastly, I mean, obviously these both of these contests have gathered attracted, I should say, a lot of attention. Again, just lastly, from a governance perspective, are there any other takeaways that observers in that world should take away, you think?
I think it's important to appreciate that companies are going to be evaluated by their shareholders, and that even the largest of companies are going to be held accountable, and that management teams are expected to execute. Management teams are expected to communicate with their investors on a regular basis. Management teams are expected to engage, and they're expected to keep their promises. And if that doesn't happen, you end up in a situation where you're really worried about what your company will look like, what your board composition will look like, what your management team will look like. When we work on the company side, we regularly help our clients understand who their investors are, how those investors think and behave, and make sure that we're helping them communicate so that a company doesn't generally get into a proxy fight by managing those expectations and setting the right goals.
Excellent. Well, Bruce Goldfarb, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your insights.
Thanks, Pat.
Governance Intelligence invites you to read its latest governance playbook, How to Prepare Your Board for the Road Ahead, sponsored by SAI 360. This comprehensive report delves into the crucial role of director education and training in board governance. Drawing from insights from governance professionals and experienced board members, it provides actionable steps and best practices for corporate secretaries to enhance their training programs. Discover how to craft agendas that cover both timeless and emerging topics essential for directors. Learn how to determine the most effective delivery methods. ensure the board remains well-equipped with the right tools to fulfill its duties and drive the company's success. To access the report today for free, head over to the Research tab at governance-intelligence.com.
Over the last several weeks, the US Department of Justice has announced two new initiatives designed to incentivize executives and other management to come forward with information about potential wrongdoing at their firms. Deputy AG Lisa Monaco in March announced the creation of a new program that will greatly expand the range of violations where whistleblowers could earn rewards. Then in mid-April, the Department of Justice announced a pilot program it says will clarify the circumstances in which prosecutors will offer non-prosecution agreements, or NPAs, to individuals who voluntarily disclose information about certain criminal conduct. The pilot includes potential immunity in some cases for individuals who've been involved in the wrongdoing. Michael Hatman, partner with Holland & Knight, joining me to share helpful advice on the likely effects of these initiatives and how general counsel should respond. I began by asking him about the NPA pilot program. Well, Michael Hammond, thank you so much for joining us. So the Department of Justice quite recently announced a pilot program. It says it's designed to provide transparency about the circumstances in which prosecutors will offer non-prosecution agreements or NPAs to individuals who come forward with information about certain types of criminal conduct involving companies. And it appears, at least the way I read it, to potentially offer immunity in some cases for individuals who've actually been involved in the wrongdoing. Could you sort of talk us through this program? How does it approach from what the DOJ has done in the past?
Yeah, certainly. Thanks for having me, Ben. So it's interesting how this pilot program dovetails really with the newly announced whistleblower rewards program. With the whistleblower program, you can't participate if you were involved in the wrongdoing. And with the pilot program offering immunity, obviously the only folks who would benefit are those who were involved in the wrongdoing. So this is clearly DOJ urging folks to call them up and offer information about wrongdoing, whether or not you were involved in the misconduct. I would say that it is new in a way, in that it is codified now. These types of incentives have historically been offered, but they're sort of case by case. And when you do it in a case by case basis, it doesn't really get a lot of attention. So I suspect that DOJ is putting it down, one, to make it clear we have this policy. If you come in and meet this criteria, you will get a non-prosecution agreement. And two, probably for some marketing purposes, so that it gets more attention on things like your program.
Always good to get some attention. So the department's memo says the NPAs, and I quote, may be a particularly important incentive for companies to create compliance programs that encourage robust internal reporting of complaints, end quote. I mean, I know that's something that's been talked about in the past with various incentives to come forward in different ways and from different agencies. Do you think this approach will have that effect? And are there any unintended effects to watch out for when you have NPAs on the table for these individuals?
I suspect the program will have the intended effect. How much of an effect is hard to predict. Offering a non-prosecution agreement to wrongdoers is obviously a huge incentive. But of course, it is not a get-out-of-jail-free card, since the program requires the person to compensate victims, to disgorge, to pay forfeiture and restitution. Those numbers could be very large and obviously creates a disincentive for those considering disclosing their involvement in illicit conduct. And when I also mentioned the numbers being large, if you talk about foreign corruption cases, if you look at the types of numbers that come out of those patterns, hundreds of millions is not unusual and billions is not even that unusual these days. But the unintended effect is ultimately that folks will bypass their internal reporting program at their company, that the safest course is not to tell your chief compliance officer, because that could result in the company disclosing the conduct and pointing the finger at you for having been involved.
Right.
Whereas here, you say you can avoid prison and avoid prosecution, but we have to have not known about it. So again, the disincentive being, I got to look out for me. I'm not going to look out for my employer, and I'm going to go to DOJ before my company can beat me to it.
Right. Which I think was similar to some of the concerns that came out when the SEC launched its whistleblowing program after Dodd-Frank was put into effect. There was a lot of concerns about how that would play out in reality.
Yes, and the reality is, though, with the SEC program, the SEC regulates a relatively small number of companies compared to the
Right.
number of companies that are out there in the world. I mean,
Right.
public companies, I think there are a few thousand in the US. You talk to private companies, private equity firms, hedge funds that aren't SEC regulated, you end up having it just could be a much, much larger pool
Right.
that DOJ would have jurisdiction over.
So with all this in mind, I mean, if if you're general counsel at a public company, for example, in the US, what should you take away from this, the MPA pilot program? Should you be, should you do like a company-wide announcement to sort of look like, if nothing else, to look like you're moving with the DOJ in the direction that it's going? Should you be updating or introducing any new policies in the company, maybe changing the terms and conditions of your, your internal sort of like hotline, compliance hotline, something like that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the focus has to be on compliance. I mean, I don't think that if I was in-house at a company, I would be advertising
Okay.
this program, but I would certainly be learning a big lesson from it, which is folks need to come and report to us when they see bad stuff. You know, I don't, not to be too glass half full about it, but historically, in my experience, when dealing with whistleblowers, a lot of them, I would say the majority of them that I've dealt with, want their company to do the right thing. They want to be taken seriously. They want their they want remedial measures put in effect into place. So I think that that would be my big focus: is our program working? Is our hot working? Are we do we have a the right tone at the top? Do we have a culture of folks you know self-reporting circumstances that the company needs to look into? And maybe do internal investigations on. So that would be where I would devote all of my energy if I was an in-house counsel or an in-house compliance
Right.
officer.
Well, something else that obviously they might devote energy to is talking to the boards, I guess, about this. And if as a general counsel, is there anything presumably you want to let the board know about this program if they haven't sort of read about it already? But are there any step anything they should particularly tell them? Any steps that the board might want to take in terms of fulfilling its oversight duties, or is it just, as you say, it's a reminder to be doing what you should be doing anyway?
Well, yeah, I think that it's a reminder to be doing what you should be doing, but it's a really this is a good argument for folks talking to board members who might not want to spend the time and the money on compliance efforts, on creating a board compliance committee where compliance personnel can brief board members without outside the presence of perhaps the C-suite. That this is not, this is the sort of wave of the future. This is where things have been going. As you mentioned, the SEC program and Dodd-Frank, the CFTC has their program, the new DOJ program that Lisa Monaco announced in early March. This is where it's all going. And any board or board member that is reticent about devoting time and energy and money to compliance is doing it at their own peril. And at the peril of their oversight duties to the board that they serve on.
And as you've mentioned previously, that in this the MPA pilot program comes after Deputy AG Lisa Monaco in March announced the new whistleblower rewards program that I think they haven't quite finalized yet, but it's going to go in effect over the next few months. Again, as you say, it's a similar rationale, right? Does it vary at all from what companies might have experienced from the like the SEC's program, for example? Is it the same kind of thing basically, or is it how might it differ?
There are differences, but the similarities are certainly greater than the differences. As I mentioned, the SEC regulates a far smaller number of companies than exist, and DOJ presumably would have a jurisdiction over a much, much larger pool of companies. The SEC program, I believe that you can have been part of the wrongdoing and still participate, whereas
Right.
DOJ's program, which hasn't been finalized, as you pointed out, But they've indicated, Deputy AG Monaco has indicated that you can have been involved in the wrongdoing in order to participate. But so it really is part and parcel of the same type of thing. And yes, there are differences at the margins, but overall, it is right. It is providing enormous financial incentives to folks who know of wrongdoing and potentially can earn generational wealth by alerting law enforcement.
And as you say, I mean, a lot of these cases, like FCPA cases, can involve, like as you say, like large amounts of money, and that does seem to be a feature of both the MPA and the whistleblower programs. Is they both sort of talk about corruption, both foreign and domestic. That seems to be theme there. Is that coming out of anything in particular, or is that just obviously the DOJ wants to cut down on corruption? That's obviously one of the things it's there for, but.
Well, yeah, they certainly do. And listen, early in the Biden administration, the president described foreign corruption and foreign bribery as a national security issue. That is, I don't even know if it's code, but that is code for this is a top priority. We see a lot of troubled regimes around the world and a lot of folks in poverty around the world. And I think the president tied it directly to corruption and cronyism. And money being taken out of the public coffers by corrupt public officials in certain nations. So when you start hearing that out of the White House, you know DOJ is going to come following that lead. Deputy AG Monaco said that there are two, while the program she announced doesn't really have any limitations in terms of the types of conduct they can go after. She mentioned two that are big focuses. One impacts matters that impact the U.S. financial system, maybe endanger it or cause it difficulties. And two, foreign corruption. So this is a top priority of the Biden administration.
And as with the MPA program that you've already sort of talked us through, is there anything that you should be doing as a general counsel or as a board in the face of this, or just something it's something to be aware of and underlines the importance of having, having internal hotlines, of having good compliance programs and controls, that sort of thing?
Yes, I think it's really more again of selling the argument of why compliance is so vital, why the company needs to take it seriously, why the company needs to reject what could be a very lucrative deal, because their counterparty has a history of problematic behavior, things of that nature. So I think it's more of what boards should have been hearing, but perhaps maybe this will drive the point home for those who didn't get the message in recent years.
Well, as I may have mentioned, but and as you know, when the SEC program, whistleblower program started, there was a lot of concern from in-house counsel and companies, I guess, that it would create liabilities potentially for them, that you might have, as you talked about, individuals going direct to the government rather than in-house. Have those attitudes changed at all? Obviously, every company is different, every executive is different, but have those attitudes kind of changed over the years? Has it become more viewed as a helpful way to sort of underline their compliance program, or is it still something that they worry about?
It remains a concern, and I think that the SEC, I don't know if it's in the policy or not. It's been a little while since I've reviewed it, but I think the SEC does emphasize that self-disclosing within your company and trying to get the company to do the right thing should be an early step. And my hope would be that DOJ will express something similar. You do not want to disincentivize folks from telling the compliance officer or the hotline when they are aware of problems. That becomes unwieldy. That becomes terribly problematic, and doesn't let companies, put in remedial measures. So it really would be an unfair consequence if you could just call up DOJ and not give your company a chance to do the right thing.
As tempting as that might be, I'm just kidding.
That may be.
well, in that case, I suppose the potential for rewards then create an incentive for companies to listen to those complaints when they're filed internally, because they're aware, well, if we don't listen to this, they might just go straight to the SEC and or DOJ. So rather than ignoring them, we should do something about them. I would imagine. I would think anyway.
Yes, I would agree with you. I would agree with
Yeah.
you.
Okay. Well, just lastly, is there anything else that our audience, should be thinking about, should take away from this, these two programs? Obviously, it's indicative, as you said, near the top of sort of DOG's priorities and wanting to encourage reporting of corporate crime. But is there anything else we should take away?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, listen, the big picture is, and my experience is that DOJ isn't necessarily looking to drop the hammer on companies that are trying to do things the right way. They don't insist on perfection. They insist on progress and they insist on effort. And I think that, listen, of course, there's always the opportunity or a possibility that you get an overly zealous prosecutor. But big picture, generally speaking, if you are making efforts and you are making strides, there are enormous incentives to have you call them before they call you. And if you don't take that approach and don't put forth the effort, they will drop the hammer on you. So I guess compliance is here and it is likely here to stay. And I would certainly encourage all companies, large and small, to put a big premium on doing business the right way and learning of potential problems and trying to remedy them.
Well, Michael Hamlin, thank you so much for your time and sharing your expertise with us today.
Great. Thank you so much, Ben. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to the latest episode of the Governance Matters podcast, brought to you by Governance Intelligence. If you enjoyed the show, please make sure to like, subscribe, and leave a review on Spotify, Google, and Apple Podcasts, Acast, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Many thanks to Noemi DiStefano at the controls, and until next time, thanks for listening.